The second morning of the Hajj, immediately after the dawn prayer, the pilgrims proceeded to Mount Arafat, 12 miles outside Mecca. There, nearly 1,400 years earlier, the prophet gave his last sermon. The second day is supposed to be a day of repentance and self-examination. But the air was charged with politics. "Don't you see how the enemies are gathering and are preparing to wage war on you?" the Grand Mufti, Sheikh Abdulaziz bin Abdullah al-Sheikh, said in his noon sermon. Many pilgrims told the Gazette team that they hoped Iraq would be victorious in the coming conflict. "America wants to control the Arab world and its wealth. We are all soldiers for Iraq," a Syrian Haji said. Later that day, Hatrash called me. He was furious because many of the stories that he and his team were writing weren't getting into the paper. And Najla Fathi gets a big story about a conference 5 days old. It was true that Najla's story about a cultural symposium in Mecca was a little stale, but it was the only piece we had in the paper reflecting the participation of women in the Hajj. Hatrash also had a piece about the first baby born during that year's pilgrimage on Mount Arafat. But another story about a Haji who had a heart attack and was brought back to life didn't run. "You sound terrible," I observed. "It's the flu, man," he said. "I thought the lemons were supposed to protect you." Hatrash admitted that he'd neglected to buy any. I worried that he was too ill to supervise the other reporters. Some of them were also getting the flu. "Now we will have to expect that they will bring it back to us," Dr. Shukani said, unsympathetically. "For the next 2 weeks, everyone will be sick." The Gazette story the next morning was headlined, "Faithful stone the devil. Make sacrifices." After spending the night praying under the stars, the pilgrims had returned to Mina, each collecting 7 pebbles along the way. Then they threw the pebbles at 3 stone pillars, called the Jamarat, which represents the place where Satan tried to tempt the prophet Muhammad. The stoning of the devil, which lasts for 3 days, is the climax of the Hajj. It is also the most dangerous period, as people jostle to the front to throw their rocks and sometimes shoes or umbrellas, crying, "Allahu Akbar." Majar Siddiqui, Sabahat's father, and the national affairs editor at the Gazette, was upset by the quotes from a couple of pilgrims who said that they were imagining George Bush when they hurled the pebbles at the devil. "What is behind this?" he asked me. "Saudi Arabia has never been a place that would talk against other countries. It has always been known for its neutrality." The subhead of the stoning story was 14 pilgrims killed in stampede. Around 10:30 on the first morning of stoning, a group of Hajis leaving the Jamarat ran into another group just arriving. There was some shoving that quickly turned to panic. 14 deaths were sufficiently routine that they didn't merit a separate article. "Something else we missed," Majar said grumpily the morning the pilgrimage ended. "It was the safest Hajj in memory." This was despite 3 stampedes and 32 pilgrims who died in traffic accidents, and 5 without valid permits who were run over as they tried to evade a checkpoint, and 1 Pakistani who was swallowed up by the sand while taking a nap. Altogether, more than 400 deaths were reported, most attributable to natural causes. Hundreds more pilgrims suffered from heat stroke or food poisoning, but fortunately, there were no epidemics. Of course, when the Gazette team came back to Jeddah, everyone in the office got sick. I kept pressing Sabahat Siddiqui to produce a draft about the aftermath of the girls' school tragedy. Sabahat, who is Pakistani, reads Arabic poorly, and so Najla agreed to study the news clips and assemble some notes for her. Najla began by reading bound volumes of Okaz in our library. Then she called Al-Madina, which was only a few blocks away. She was told that she could request pages for 50 rials each, about $14. But as a woman, she could not enter the information center, nor would library clerks bring the clippings to her in the ladies' section. The public library should have all the clippings on microfilm, I suggested. Women aren't allowed in the public library except one day a week, Najla informed me. And since there was a limit on how much she would be allowed to copy, no more than a few pages at a time, it would take her weeks to gather all the material. I told her I would call the editor of Al-Madina and ask him to help her. Also, I was sure there was a library at the women's college that she could use. The important thing was to get the facts about what occurred when the fire started and what the government had promised to do afterward. There's another problem, she said. There are some people who don't like knowing about depressing things, and one of those people is me. She paused. What makes me upset is that in my reading, I see that maybe some people are covering up. She wouldn't tell me what she had learned. After a few weeks, I asked her why she hadn't gone to Mecca to interview the families or visited local schools to see if fire codes had been enacted. Things are getting better, she insisted. She refused to dig any deeper. Her reluctance puzzled me. Perhaps she was afraid of the authorities. One of the editors had told me that the women believed I was forcing them to do stories that were critical of the government. But Najla was one of our most ambitious reporters. Perhaps she felt protective of her society and didn't want to expose its shortcomings, although she had not hesitated to express criticism in conversation. In any case, her caution was so deeply embedded that I could not break through. Without her aid, Sabahat could not continue, and the story died. The first anniversary of the school fire came and went, largely unremarked, in the Saudi press. In frustration, I made some inquiries on my own. When I had first heard of the tragedy, I imagined that the girls were trampled as they fell in a stairwell or crushed against the locked gate. Then I spoke to Dr. Khaled Abu El Fadl, a law professor at UCLA and a member of the Board of Human Rights Watch. He told me that he had received a call from a businessman in Mecca who claimed to be the father of one of the dead girls. He was at work, a 10-minute drive from the school, Abu El Fadl told me. He got a call and rushed over, and there he encountered police and firemen. He pushed his way through, and then he noticed the mutawa. A few minutes later, the father said, his daughter ran to the gate with a group of girls. The girls pleaded for someone to let them out. She was screaming, "Break the lock, break the lock!" Abu El Fadl continued. The smoke was overwhelming. It was very hot. One of the girls was screaming that her clothes were sticking to her skin. 17 fire engines had responded to the alarm, along with members of the civil defense squad. Between them and the desperate students stood the mutawa. None of the representatives of Saudi society standing outside the gate of the girls' school, the police, the firemen, the parents, the bystanders, were able to summon the collective will to ignore the mutawa and save the girls. The man who called Abu El Fadl said he was afraid of challenging the religious police. They sent his daughter back into the school to get her abaya. She burned to death. He said, "I want the criminals tried. They murdered my daughter. Help me bring justice," Abu El Fadl told me. But that was the last he heard from the man. No one was prosecuted for the deaths. The chief of police in Mecca told the Associated Press at the time that he had arrived to find a mutawa. He mentions only one, quarreling with a police officer. "I immediately instructed him to leave, and he did," he said. The government said that there would be a follow-up investigation, but nothing came of it. Great stories often arise from what might be called representative tragedies, those that expose warring social forces that are at the heart of people's everyday concerns. The fire in the girls' school had that epical quality. It posed questions about the roles of women and religion that went to the heart of the Saudi dilemma. Was it true that a single mutawa had blocked the town from saving the girls? Didn't he effectively murder them? What did it say about the misplaced power of religion that a father would send his daughter back into a burning building to retrieve her abaya? Would he rather have her dead than disgraced? Why was the initial investigation covered up? Why did the government stop the press from pursuing the story? Why did the press so meekly obey? Men in white, women in black. The basic Saudi wardrobe expresses a polarity between the sexes that is absolute. The men look monkish in their gown-like thobes, made of cotton or silk, and the black bands around their headscarves reminded me of halos. They are as nearly covered up as the women, except those who, like Najla, choose to conceal their face. At first I was frustrated by how little information I could gain about a man from looking at his white clothes, but soon I learned to read the accessories: the pen, the watch, the shoes, each of which was freighted with status. Nearly every Saudi man has facial hair. A long, full beard marks a man as pious. An untrimmed beard, a thobe that is a couple of inches shorter than usual, and the absence of a headband to hold the scarf in place, this is the costume of fundamentalists and the mutawa. Some Saudi men wear socks and shoes, but many prefer flat sandals made of ostrich or crocodile skin. Headscarves have a red check or white-on-white pattern, but even these seemingly identical garments are full of nuance to the Saudi eye, which picks up the Valentino or Christian Dior name sewn into the weave. Heavy platinum Rolexes or Tag Heuers complete their wardrobes. Islam allows only women to wear gold. The strict separation of the sexes is a comparatively recent phenomenon, as Abdullah al-Sheri, a professor of linguistics at King Abdulaziz University, explained during a long conversation in a Starbucks. There is a religious term, kalwa, which means a man and a woman who are unrelated and are behind a closed door, Abdullah said. There is another term, iktilat. This is an invented term. It is heard only in Saudi Arabia and is never mentioned in any religious text. It means mixing of more than two men and women. There is confusion between these two terms in the Saudi mind. The Prophet said whenever a man and a woman are in kalwa, Satan will join them. But iktilat is part of the Saudi tribal culture. Before I was born, in the 30s and 40s, men and women used to celebrate weddings together. Now, bride and groom have separate wedding celebrations. Traditions say that eating alone with your female relatives is shameful, Raid Kusti, a journalist, wrote in a daring column for the Crosstown Arab News. Where in our religion does it say that sitting with your own family is forbidden? Kusti complained that many Saudi men thought it was taboo to utter a woman's name in public. Ask any Saudi male in the street what the names of his wife or daughters are, and you will either have embarrassed him or insulted him. Islamic? Not in any way. There are some parts of the country where a woman never unveils. Her husband and children see her face only when she dies. Women will always be the core issue that will hinder any social progress in Saudi Arabia, Kusti wrote. We limit their roles in public, ban them from public participation in decision-making. We doubt them and confine them because we think they are the source of all seduction and evil in the world. And then we say proudly, we are Muslims. A middle-aged Saudi told me, I am worried about the next generation. They don't see any real women at all. You don't see each other's wives, daughters, sisters. Everything is masculine. And yet, they are bombarded by images. They can easily see porn. They live in the imagination of sex all the time. We don't grow naturally to be loved. Not to be loved. We don't undergo these changes. 2/3 of the marriages here are basically loveless. Many men cheat. There's a lot going on underground. Some Saudi men openly joke about their behavior when they leave the country. We're all sex maniacs, by the way, one said to me. He regularly flies to Morocco for female companionship. There's a part of me that I share with all men where women are concerned, and there's a part I share with Arab men, but there's a big part that only Saudi guys have in common. The absence of socialization between men and women struck me as a potent factor in terrorist fantasies. The hijackers who killed themselves on September 11th were propelled in part by the notion of being rewarded in the afterlife with the company of virgins. Such abstractions don't seem quite so strange in a country where images of women piped through a satellite dish seem more vivid than actual Saudi women, whom the male reporters at the Gazette liked to call BMOs, or black moving objects. In Dr. Shukani's office, there was a doll wearing an abaya. I knew how much he hated the garment. He told me that he had once accused a woman friend of loving her abaya when she should spurn it. Naturally, he attacked it on a literary level. In the past, females were an object of shame in Arabia, he had told her. Fathers would bury their daughters alive. The abaya is a symbolic representation of this kind of female burial. As a teasing rejoinder, his friend gave him the doll. The year before I arrived in the kingdom, there had been a brief attempt at introducing blue abayas. The religious police rampaged through the garment stores, pulling all the non-black versions off the shelves. Then, in Jeddah, which considers itself the most liberal Saudi city, a new abaya suddenly appeared. Black, but diaphanous and form-fitting, gaining the fervent endorsement of the Gazette's young male reporters. But those disappeared from the stores as quickly as they appeared. The abaya obliterates fashion and curtains off women's bodies, but the gowns themselves are various and full of meaning to those who can read the signs. Some go from the head, some from the shoulder, some are open, some are closed, Najla explained to me. We were speaking on the phone, as usual, since individual meetings between the two of us would have been taboo. Sabahat's gown, she pointed out, buttoned up the front and had an attractive embroidered trim. There are others that look a bit like opera capes with stylish hoods. Najla wears a closed abaya that is like a cotton poncho and is called a baltu. My baltu is my personal design, Najla said. Every year she goes to a tailor to have a new one made. I always try to make it more conservative, she said. A few years ago I saw some abayas with a covering for the hands. I added that. She used to cover her entire face as well, but her glasses made that impractical. So she wears the niqab, a covering that goes over her nose and under the gold rims of her cat-eye glasses. By the way, some people think we make faces under the veil,
And we do,
she confided. Why do you cover your face at all? I asked. In the world of male prejudice, why not? She said. Another time she told me, I just don't like people staring at me. She began wearing the abaya when she was about 14. She gave it up when she came to the United States to study, although she continued to wear the headscarf, with a long-sleeved shirt and long pants. When Najla returned home, she adopted the full veil. There's not any other girl in my family who has done what I did, she said. They uncover their faces. They shake men's hands. I don't. Before going to America, she studied biology at King Faisal University in Dammam, living in a dorm, her window facing a high wall so that no one could see in. After Maghrib, the sunset prayers, I'd get really sad, she recalled. I couldn't live there any longer. I was spending time learning English just to get my family to agree to let me go to America to get my degree. I didn't want to come back to Jeddah because I was afraid they would make me marry someone I didn't like. Hearing Najla's stories, I pictured her parents clenching their teeth as they dealt with this strong-willed daughter. After 3 years in King Faisal, I said to my family, no more. I quit school and came home. They said, get married. I said, no. Her brothers were in America, and she wanted to go too. Najla's parents agreed to let her finish her bachelor's degree in Kentucky. My first interest was in politics, she continued. I spoke to my dad. He said, you won't go into politics. I won't spend a penny on you. Reluctantly, she began studying microbiology. After she got her bachelor's degree, Najla wanted to remain in the States for more study. But her family ordered her home to get married. It was to someone I really didn't want, she said. She had never had a date in her life. The marriage ended quickly. I had a divorce. I forced him to do that. Divorce is a drastic step in a country where women's lives are so circumscribed, and yet more than 20% of Saudi marriages end in divorce within a single year. Without a man in their home, divorced women are shunned in Saudi society. As a consequence, they tend to form their own community. There is even a road in Riyadh called the Street of Divorcees. Saudi marriages suffer from all the usual afflictions: infidelity, incompatibility, household violence, but the biggest problem is polygamy. In Islam, a man is allowed up to 4 wives at a time, and many Saudi husbands continually change partners, a practice that causes constant heartache. Having ended her marriage, Najla continued to push for independence. I got out of microbiology, she said. I thought, it's my life, I'm going to do what I want. I'm going to be a politician, no matter what other people think. She went back to Kentucky and got a master's degree in political science. I asked her what she understood politics to mean in a country with no political system. She said that she was referring to something like social work. It's a term I use, she said. Speaking of her Gazette work, she said, this job might not be at the level of what I understand a politician is. She added, as a journalist, there are so many ways you can push society forward. But is it effective? Another time she admitted, I no longer know what I want. Najla travels quite freely, although she needs her father's written permission to leave town. Her family has a driver, but Najla doesn't like him, so within Jeddah she usually goes by cab. Either way, she thinks that it is improper to be confined in the same vehicle with a man. At the very least, she believes, there should be a partition between the woman and the driver. The best solution, she says, is allowing women to drive. We have to pay for drivers, she said. This is a burden on women. Until 1990, there was no law forbidding women to drive. The social prohibition was sufficient. That year, more than 200,000 American troops, including women GIs who drove trucks and jeeps, arrived in the kingdom to repel the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. 50 Saudi women decided that it was the right time to challenge tradition. They met in front of a Safeway in Riyadh and ordered their drivers out of their cars, then took a 30-minute spin through the capital. The police detained them, but there was no legal reason to arrest them. The Interior Minister immediately banned the practice. The Grand Mufti at the time, Abdul Aziz bin Baz, helpfully added a fatwa, calling female driving a source of depravity. The female drivers' passports were seized, and those who were employed lost their jobs. Several of them had been professors at the Women's College of King Saud University, and the king himself suspended them after their own female students protested that they did not want to be taught by infidels. On a warm Saturday morning, I went to the beach with Hassan Hatrash, Hassan Baswaid, and Mamdou Al-Harthi. They took me to a secluded compound north of town run by the Sheraton. It was designated for Westerners, but everyone there was Arab. It was one of the few places in Jeddah where men and women could mix freely. Hatrash brought his guitar and a keyboard for me. We spent the day jamming, playing blues and reggae tunes beside the Red Sea. At one point, Hatrash launched into Redemption Song by Bob Marley. "Emancipate yourselves from mental slavery," he sang. "None but ourselves can free our minds." Then we had a barbecue with a mixed group of their friends. After dinner, someone brought out an oud, the Arabian lute. Hatrash picked up a drum. Hassan Baswaid took over the keyboard, and the music took a sinuous turn. We sat there till late at night, men and women together, enjoying the light breeze wafting across the water from Africa, a fleeting vision of what Saudi Arabia could be like without the enforced piety that holds the sexes apart. One afternoon I was in the Al Mamlaka Mall in Riyadh, waiting with other shoppers for the stores to open after sunset prayers. A group of Filipino guys who were hanging out in front of Planet Hollywood abruptly rushed away, like a flock of ducks taking flight. Behind them came a mutawa. He was a squat man with a wide red face and a black beard down to his chest. Over his shortened thobe, he wore a sheer black mashallah, a ceremonial robe with gold piping on the sleeves. As he walked, he leaned backward into his authority, his thumbs stuck in the lapels of his mashallah. On either side of him, and a step behind, were two Saudi policemen. They were comical bookends, tall and skinny, with berets and stringy fundamentalist beards. I decided to follow them around the mall, which has four stories, the top floor for women only. We circumnavigated the complex as the mutawa shooed the men to a nearby mosque, reprimanded women whose attire failed to conform to his standards, peeked in store windows at decapitated mannequins to make sure that no surreptitious shopping was taking place, and looked in restaurants to make certain that they were closed for prayers. Later, I asked Prince Al-Walid bin Talal bin Abdulaziz Al-Saud, the mall's owner, who was one of the richest men in the world, about the bullying mutawa. "I personally talked to the boss of that chap, who was a bit on the rough side," he told me. "If you talk to their leaders, they are logical, pragmatic people." I said, "Your guys are scaring the heck out of people." He gave them orders to change. The religious police often seem intent on making themselves ridiculous. They will randomly black out faces in advertisements in the malls so that a men's store will feature a headless photograph of a man in a Hugo Boss suit, while posters in a nearby Gap are untouched. A number of Saudis told me that many of the Mutawa are ex-convicts who would be unemployable except for the fact that in prison they memorized the Quran. They receive a bounty from the government for every arrest they make, reportedly $300 for every Saudi and half that for a foreigner. One Jeddah resident described them as an occupying force. He told me that they had recently burst in on the graduation ceremony of his daughter's French elementary school and ordered the children to stop singing Alouette. One evening in Riyadh, I was climbing into a cab when I noticed something highly unusual. A woman standing on the corner with her head uncovered. She was remarkably beautiful and looked directly at me. I could see the fear in her eyes. I almost asked if I could give her a lift, but that would have been an unthinkable breach of custom. As an unmarried couple in the same car, we could both be taken to jail. So I said nothing. My cab had to make a U-turn, and when we came back past the corner, I saw the woman running. She now had the hood of her abaya over her hair. She ran to a shop and tried to open the door, but it was closed for prayers. Then I saw that she was being trailed by a Suburban with the emblem of the Commission for the Promotion of Virtue and Prevention of Vice on the door. The woman went from door to door, banging on the glass. Every instinct in me cried out to help her, yet I could think of nothing that would not make the situation worse. I rode on, feeling guilty and helpless, as the Mutawa closed in. At times, the main target of the religious police seemed to be not virtue, but love. Boys and girls are kept strictly separate throughout their education, and the Mutawa patrol public places, trying to keep romance at bay. The week before Valentine's Day, the Mutawa began going through card and flower shops, attacking anything that had hearts on it or was red, the color of romance. Florists hid their roses as if they were contraband. Flirting takes place in opportunistic bursts, at stoplights or in the mall, where telephone numbers are furtively exchanged. Some young people adopt riskier strategies. To see his girlfriend in public, Mamdou, the Bedouin reporter, dressed up in an abaya. "I do it all the time," he confessed. Hassan Baswed told me that the best way to get around the Mutawa and meet girls was through the internet. He had met a nice girl in a chat room, and he began talking with her on the telephone. Finally, they arranged to meet in a cafe, each bringing a sister as an escort. They enjoyed the date, and within 3 months, Baswed decided to propose. The girl accepted, and there was a small engagement party, which included meeting with her relatives to haggle over the dowry. "After that, she is my wife," he told me the day of the meeting. The next morning, Baswed returned to the office a married man, although he and his wife couldn't live together until after a wedding ceremony, which would be held a few weeks later. We met that day in the Okaz cafeteria. He was already a little nostalgic for his bachelor days. We began talking about parties, and he recalled a rather wild event he had attended a few years earlier. Except for the feast days at the end of Ramadan and the Hajj, all holidays, including birthdays, are nominally banned in the kingdom. One year, however, he visited his cousin in Dubai, and his cousin's wife, who is American, held a Halloween masquerade. "She wanted me to dress up like a woman," he confessed. "And did you?" He laughed, a little embarrassed. "I went to the party for about 15 minutes, then said I had to leave. I went upstairs with my cousin's wife. She owns a beauty salon." The relative put Nair on Baswed's legs and shaved his arms and mustache, and even his eyebrows. At the time, I wore my hair really long, so she curled it. She gave me some pantyhose and a dress with socks in the bra, and then I went downstairs. The disguise was surprisingly convincing, and he began to flirt, even plopping himself on a good friend's lap. Soon, of course, the guests figured out who he really was. His buddy was mad, but the women were intrigued by his role-playing.
They were like kissing me. They even let me come into the women's bathroom.
He had a great time, he said,
but I hated myself in the morning. I woke up with no eyebrows.
What does your family think about you being here? Hassan Hatrash asked me one afternoon. We were sitting on the floor of the Gazette newsroom having lunch, a large platter of grilled chicken and rice, which we ate with our fingers. They're all terrified, I admitted.
How did we get into this situation where everybody thinks we're terrorists? He said miserably.
The West's fear of the Arab world was mirrored by many Saudis I talked to. Young people who had been studying in the West were afraid to return there. Businessmen confessed that they would feel humiliated if they tried to travel to the United States and were fingerprinted upon entering the country. These were men who had once enjoyed the nearly universal access that a Saudi passport vouchsafed them. For most of the country's business and intellectual leaders, and for many of the royals, the Western world had been a refuge from the intellectual and sensual sterility of the kingdom. I suspected that many had nurtured a secret escape plan in case the extremists gained complete control. They would retreat to second homes in Santa Barbara or Miami, but now such places seemed hostile to them. These elite men who had prided themselves on living in two worlds felt trapped in their own stern culture, and they were suffocating. I went with Dr. Shukani one evening to hear an Arab-American political consultant, Hadi Amer, speak about Saudi-U.S. relations. "Be rational when you talk to Americans," he advised. "It's okay to be passionate, but don't raise your voices or wave your hands." That seemed to be a needless admonition. The men in the audience were subdued, almost numb. After the lecture, Shukani drove me back to my apartment. He reflected on what America had meant to him. He had grown up in a small village in Asir, the southern province where several of the hijackers were from. Like most boys in that part of the country at the time, Shukani was a shepherd, and he curled his hair and decorated it with flowers. He did not see an automobile until he was 10 years old.
"Most men my age, they will tell you the same story," he said.
For Shukani, America was just a rumor on the other side of the horizon, and yet he and thousands of young men like him went there to study, often gravitating to sheltered university towns. As a matter of fact, Shukani went to the University of Texas in Austin, where I live. Young intellectuals like Shukani became repositories of Western science and art, and they returned to fill the faculties of the new Saudi universities. For some of these men, the return to their own country was a kind of exile. They had traveled too far, and they would never be entirely at home anywhere. Immediately after September 11th, Shukani told me, he had called to check on an old Saudi friend who had stayed in the United States. His friend said that he had been well-treated, but he was filled with anxiety nonetheless.
"The people are fine," he said. "I think it's me. There's still some desert wildness inside me."
I was surprised how open these naturally reticent Saudis were about their state of mind. One morning, several of the Gazette reporters admitted to me that they were depressed.
"Last night I didn't even sleep," Hassan Hatrash told me. "I just sat on the beach till 4 in the morning. When I do sleep, it's like I'm dead for 3 days."
I worried about them, especially Hatrash. He was always forgetting to eat,
and during meetings he jiggled his leg nervously. In many respects, he was our best reporter. But music was his passion. There wasn't a place for him in a society that smothered art and other pleasures. The fact that he was in his late 20s, lived at home, and couldn't meet women, and couldn't afford to marry one if he did, also weighed on him. In the Gazette, Baswade reported on a survey of more than 2,000 students in Jeddah, aged 13 to 25, that was conducted by a researcher at King Abdulaziz University. 65% of the boys and 72% of the girls showed symptoms of depression. Drug use was nearly 5% for both sexes, as was the rate of alcoholism, even though alcohol was strictly forbidden. 5% alcoholism among intermediate and high school students in an Islamic country is jarring to our ears, a professor at the university told Baswade. What struck me was the rate of attempted suicide, which is strictly forbidden in Islam. 7% of the girls admitted that they had attempted to kill themselves, more than twice the rate of the boys. One afternoon, I went to the gym near my apartment and started doing yoga exercises. A Saudi man saw me doing a headstand. He walked over, bent down, and cranked his head sideways. "Is that good for depression?" he asked. "It might be," I said. "Can you show me how to do it?" I helped him up against a wall, and after a while he learned to hold the position. When I went back to the locker room, it was prayer time, and four men happened to be praying on the floor, directly facing my locker. I waited for them to finish. One of them asked me afterward if I would start a yoga class. "Maybe it will help relieve the stress," he said. Such polite entreaties caught me off guard. Before arriving in Saudi Arabia, I had expected loud confrontations that went on into the night, as I had experienced in Cairo in the spring of 2002. I found neither open anger nor the natural exuberance, humor, and mischief that are so much a part of the Egyptian character. Instead, there was quiet despair, an ominous emotional flatness. "Don't you guys ever tell jokes?" I asked one Saudi friend. "Of course," he said. "We're very funny. So, tell me a Saudi joke." He thought for a moment and finally offered this. A Somali, an Egyptian, and a Saudi are asked, "What is your opinion of eating meat?" The Somali said, "What is eating?" The Egyptian said, "What is meat?" And the Saudi said, "What's an opinion?" In March, a soft-spoken, retired chemistry professor invited me to have lunch at his house in Riyadh. The place was impressive. It had marble floors and two large public rooms with the chairs pushed against the wall, in the Islamic style. I learned that his wife and daughters would be joining us, an extraordinarily kind and progressive gesture for such a conservative man. The presentation of a Saudi family is a careful ritual. The protocol begins with the entry of the youngest son, who in this case was an officer in the Saudi Air Force and a veteran of the Gulf War. After we chatted for a few minutes, the older son, a banker, joined us. Then the father came in and accepted a kiss on the top of his head from his older son. They invited me to the kitchen to eat, rather than the dining room, which was an honor. The professor's wife appeared and sat down at the head of a long table, and we began to eat from 8 huge platters of food. Then, one by one, his 4 grown daughters and daughters-in-law came to the table. They were all intelligent, well-educated, and hospitable, and the conversation was so agreeable that I was unprepared for the argument that followed. The professor began talking about the black boxes in the hijacked planes that had struck the World Trade Center. He questioned the Americans' claim that they had not survived. Then he spoke about the unsolved anthrax poisonings that followed the attack, suggesting that it was the U.S. government that had carried them out to scare people. "What kind of country do you think we are?" I said heatedly. "Do you think we are really so wicked that we would poison our own citizens?" "You have gotten angry in my house," the professor said, offended. The conversation inevitably turned toward the notion that Mossad or the CIA had engineered the 9/11 hijackings. The logic is based on two assumptions: that these organizations were scheming for an excuse to attack the Arab world, and that Arabs are too incompetent to have pulled off the attacks. I had had the same discussion countless times. "Let's ask your son," I suggested, when the professor said that none of the hijackers had sufficient training to handle a commercial airliner. "Let's ask the pilot how hard it is." The officer looked at his father and said, "To ram a skyscraper on a cloudless day? I should think it would be the easiest thing in the world." The room was quiet. The family stunned, I think, that the younger son would openly contradict his father. "Do you accept his testimony?" I gently asked the father. But he only turned away. I had the sense that the generations were engaged in a struggle over the future of the country, but it was not at all clear that the young had a better vision of what needed to be done. I went one evening to a diwaniya, a weekly men's dinner that is a kind of literary and political salon. We sat on the floor until past midnight, eating from platters of lamb and rice. Most of the men were professionals, lawyers, editors, and doctors. "We were educated in America, and I see the world going against everything I have built," said Dr. Mujahid al-Sawaf, a lawyer in Jeddah and a former professor at al-Qura University in Mecca. "We were always for liberalism, but some of the terrorists were my students." "My daughter is for bin Laden," another man admitted. "When I go to wake her up, I see pictures of Palestinian girl martyrs on her wall. It scares me to death. If we go into her room at night, she'll be listening to Britney Spears. But as soon as we close the door, she's listening to martyr songs." The other men nodded. They come to us and say, "Dad, why didn't you fight in 1948 and 1967? They see us as cowards," a dentist said. One of the children said to me, "Uncle, is it true that when you went to the West, you became a puppet, like our leadership?" Our kids don't want to study in America, as we did. Bin Laden changed our life. He proved that mighty America is vulnerable. To us, we're afraid of our future. But the youth think America is on the verge of collapsing, and it's time for us to fight it. We are afraid of our children. On a bright April morning, I drove up to Taif, a lovely mountain town in the great Sarawat Range. It looks out over a sheer cliff toward the Red Sea. Behind Taif is the vast Saudi desert, stretching all the way to the Persian Gulf. In front is the Hejaz, a narrow strip of coastal land that includes Jeddah, as well as the holy cities of Mecca and Medina. Taif is only 55 miles up the mountain from Mecca, but the kingdom was not fully consolidated until a road was built, connecting the two halves. It had been such a formidable engineering problem that no reputable company would undertake the challenge, until a one-eyed, illiterate contractor named Mohammed bin Laden submitted a bid. There's a story that Osama often told about his father. When it came time to lay out the road, Mohammed pushed a donkey over the edge of the escarpment and followed him down the long, looping path, marking the route of the future highway. When the road was completed, in 1962, the kingdom was united, and Mohammed bin Laden became a national hero. Taif was important to 9/11 for two reasons. One is that the Prophet Muhammad laid siege to the city in the year 630. The Muslim army received permission from their leader to use a catapult to breach the city's defenses, even though women and children would be harmed. Al-Qaeda would later use this precedent to justify the killing of innocents on 9/11, comparing the use of airplanes to that of the catapult 14 centuries before. The other reason is that one of Taif's citizens was Hani Hanjour, one of the four hijacker pilots who crashed into the Pentagon that day, killing 125 people in the building and the 64 passengers and crew on American Airlines Flight 77. I picked up a reporter from a Saudi business paper, and we parked outside the imposing two-story marble house where Hanjour grew up. Like most of the hijackers, he was a product of the middle class. His father was a provisioner for a nearby military base. Sometime after midnight, Yasser Hanjour came outside and got into the back seat. Slight and meek, he looked like a clone of his sad-eyed older brother. As he saw it, his brother's story was a simple one. Hani had never wanted to be anything other than a pilot. He had trained in America, where he had suddenly become very religious. When he returned from his first trip there, he applied for a job at Saudi Arabian Airlines, but was turned down. He disappeared into his room for 6 months. "Why was he so depressed?" I asked. "You know the reason," the business reporter interjected impatiently. "This joblessness." Yasser shrugged and agreed. There was a sameness to the stories of the hijacker pilots. They had become Muslim extremists in Europe and America, presumably as a way of holding on to their sense of who they were in the engulfing West. Their own cultures offered them no way to be powerful in the world. Traditionally, the Saudi government absorbed nearly all the university graduates, but after the oil shock of the mid-80s, the government, saddled with debt, could no longer hire as before. Unemployment and idleness became central facts of life for young Saudi men, as they had always been for Saudi women. Bin Laden gave young men with no control over their lives an identity and a wanton chance to make history. "Death is better than life in humiliation," Bin Laden said. That was a constant theme of Bin Laden's speeches. One of the critical documents in understanding his motivation is his declaration of war against the Americans occupying the land of the two holy places, written in 1996, in which he cites the sources of Arabs' shame. Although the declaration calls on Muslims everywhere to fight Jews and Crusaders, the heart of its argument is a populist attack on the mismanagement of the Saudi economy. Everybody talks about the deterioration of the economy, about inflation, and about the ever-increasing debts, he writes. More than 340 billion Saudi rials are owed by the government to the people, in addition to the daily accumulated interest, let alone the foreign debt. People wonder whether we are the largest oil-exporting country. They even believe that this situation is a curse put on them by Allah for not objecting to the oppressive and illegitimate behavior and measures of the ruling regime. In a country where discontent with the ruling family is widespread but rarely expressed directly, where resentment against the power and influence of the West is nearly universal, and where unemployment is creating a class of well-educated but idle young men, Bin Laden's words resonated so strongly, in part, because no one else would say them. "Our society is confused," Abdullah al-Sheri, the linguistics professor, told me during another Starbucks seminar. He was from the same tribe as three of the 15 Saudi hijackers, but that scarcely sets him apart in a country whose inhabitants are so intimately bound together. It bothers me a lot when I see things about our society that are negative or backward, which in the West are blamed on religion. You can easily look at Muslim history, at the Umayyads and the Abbasids, and see how powerful Islamic culture was then. What has changed is the mentality and the culture. Islam is a religion of tolerance, but now there is a sense of frustration and defeat that makes people hate others. For some, hate becomes their only weapon. If you can't beat them, hate them. From now on, you should be Mr. Sewage, I said to Hassan Hatrash, who was not quite persuaded. It will make your career. This is a holy shit story, I guarantee you. He laughed. Yeah, I see your point, man, he said. The sewage story would require Hatrash, who had never finished college, to learn about geology, epidemiology, sewage treatment, dams, city building codes, and legal procedures. He was intimidated, but he was also a quick study. His self-taught English was so fluent that he could pass for an American, or a Jamaican. He also spoke passable Japanese and German. He began to explore the story cautiously, not entirely trusting my enthusiasm. What was the point of writing an exposé in a country where it couldn't be published? I took him to interview Hussein Shabokshi, the contractor who had originally told me about the sewage scandal. He received us in a dark office, whose walls were covered with beautiful examples of Arabic calligraphy. I pulled out my legal pad and my tape recorder. Hatrash took a folded sheet of notebook paper from the pocket of his thobe. I asked Shabokshi why he was bothering to sue Jeddah's former director of sewage. Saudi courts have always been protective of government officials. Hyundai won a case against the Ministry of Public Works, Shabokshi told us. So that got me thinking, maybe the judicial system is willing to raise the bar a bit. We began collecting testimonials. It's been my crusade. Shabokshi started cataloging the costs of the sewage crisis. Real estate prices had dropped by 70% in some districts. The beaches were polluted and marine life was dying. Sewage was eating into the city's limestone bedrock. He gave us references for medical sources and environmental studies, including one commissioned by the Jeddah Chamber of Commerce and Industry that he said warned of a hepatitis epidemic. We will see people dying, and buildings will collapse. It will certainly get worse before it gets better. When we left Shabokshi's office, Hatrash was excited. He began talking about all the sources he was going to interview. I asked to see his notes. I could see some figures, more than 60% of the palm trees were dying, for instance, scribbled on the folded paper. But the texture of Shabokshi's conversation was missing. I gave him a little lecture about the importance of capturing quotes, and then sent him off to pursue the story. Meanwhile, I went to speak with Ramesh Balan, the managing editor of the Gazette. A non-Muslim from southern India, he darted around the newsroom like a hummingbird, and he talked faster than he moved. If you could hold him in place for a moment, you would observe a dashing, graying man in his mid-40s. One day he emerged from his office and cried, "Look at this!" He was waving a copy of the Arab News. The headline reported the arrest of 8 Al-Qaeda suspects involved in a January shootout in Riyadh. "Local coverage, here on the front page," he said jealously. "I'm going to retaliate." Ramesh handed me a bunch of letters to the editor and said that perhaps they would inspire an assignment. In the pile was a handwritten letter from a Saudi soldier. "Please help us," it said. The writer complained that all the soldiers in his unit had just seen their salaries cut in half. I called Hassan Baswed over to my desk. Do you know anybody in the military? I asked. Busway nodded. He had more connections than anyone else in the office. I handed him the soldier's letter. Why don't you call around and see if other soldiers are having their salaries cut? This could be a big story. Busway quickly set the letter back on my desk. He put his hands together as if they were in handcuffs. This could put you in the calaboose, he said with a sheepish grin. A little while later, however, he came by my desk and told me of a rumor that had washed over the city. The Bin Ladens were changing their name. They're going to call themselves Awada, he said. It was Osama Bin Laden's grandfather's name. Their motivation for making the change was understandable, if it was true. Hassan, get this story, and your byline will be on the front page of every paper in the world. Buswade shrugged and gave me a look. Let me worry about getting it published, I said. Do you think you can get someone to confirm it? Buswade became very sober. I know Osama's son, Abdullah, a little, he said. Can you talk to him? Maybe. Buswade started making calls on his mobile phone. Meanwhile, I went to visit Ramesh again. He was smarting from a confrontation with Dr. Ahmed Al-Yusuf, the Gazette's editor-in-chief, a man I saw only rarely. Ramesh said he had wanted to run a big story about Libya withdrawing its ambassador to the kingdom after a clash between Muammar Gaddafi and Crown Prince Abdullah at an Arab League meeting. Dr. Yusuf ordered that the story be played down. He doesn't know what real press freedom is, Ramesh said. He took a few deep breaths. I'm about to have a nervous breakdown. I told him about Hassan Buswade's story. Will you print it? I asked. If they don't print it, I'll quit, he exclaimed. He suddenly seemed exhilarated. Ramesh then offered me an exciting piece of information. The sewage workers in Jeddah were on strike. We both felt a little giddy. We could envision the Gazette front page with the Bin Laden name change, a city sewage strike, and a reference to the withdrawal of the Libyan ambassador. What a news day! I sent Hassan Hatrush off to the municipal yard where the sewage trucks typically gathered. The drivers aren't on strike, he reported. They are afraid because the police are impounding their trucks. As a result, the drivers were staying home, letting the waste build up. Why in the world would they do that? Hatrush said he would find out, but it was already after 10 p.m., and the paper's deadline was only an hour away. Meanwhile, Buswade was standing at my desk, expectantly. I found Abdullah bin Laden, he told me. He's having dinner right now at the Italian restaurant. The restaurant was in a strip shopping center off Medina Road, about 20 minutes away. Less, given Buswade's driving, which I decided to think of as a kind of video game. There was a small patio in front of the restaurant, and four young men were seated at a table, laughing. Buswade and I entered with studied casual chatter, planning to make it all seem natural. Abdullah and two of his friends wore thobes. The other friend was in jeans and wore a Rasta hat. All were in their middle 20s. We sat down at a table next to theirs, and Abdullah bin Laden took no apparent notice. He was tall and clean-shaven, and his head was uncovered. His hair was close-cropped, almost stubbly. His nose was long and flat, like his father's. The mild eyes were the same. Buswade got up and went inside the restaurant, then returned to the patio with a pack of cigarettes. He pretended to have just recognized Abdullah and walked over, smiling. A few pleasantries were exchanged. Then Abdullah turned to be introduced to me. In the Saudi style, he brushed my hand and touched his heart. Buswade asked the question. Abdullah denied the rumor. It's my name, and I am very proud of it. There is no way to change it, he said. He didn't sound plaintive or embarrassed. Should we do a story anyway? Buzzwade asked, as we watched the young men getting into an SUV with darkened windows. I suggested that Buzzwade continued to ask around, to find out, for instance, if the Saudi Bin Laden Group, the family construction company, was changing its name. There was still a possibility that the family would seek the change on their passports, but more reporting would be required before the story could run. The next morning, the Gazette's front page did carry Hassan Hatrash's story, headlined, "Jeddah Sewage Disposal Stops." The drivers were perplexed, he reported. We don't know why the cops are harassing us, one said. Homeowners were already complaining of overflowing septic tanks that were flooding the city streets. In a single skillful anecdote, Hassan caught the sense of a disaster in the making. Irfan Khan, an Indian who had just got back from work to find his ground floor apartment in a total mess from overflowing toilets, was livid with rage. Come look at my carpets, my kitchen. How will I ever live here now? He raved. Get back in, he broke off to yell at two children wanting to try out the stepping stones dotting a cesspool on the street. Now there'll be mosquitoes and disease, and already there is a dengue fever scare in the city. By the time the article appeared, the impact of the sewage problem was obvious throughout Jeddah. In many places, the streets were wet. Hideous lakes were forming out of gurgling spouts. Nevertheless, no other newspaper had taken notice of the crisis. Hatrash then learned that the police were confiscating the trucks because the drivers hadn't paid a new disposal fee at the sewage pond. He tracked down the idle drivers, then came back and wrote a story that began, "Police have impounded trucks in the past week because of a failure to remit a new disposal fee." "How much is the fee?" I asked. "5 rials." "About $1." "This whole city is drowning in shit because of 5 rials? Hassan, paint the picture. Sewage collection has stopped. Toilets are overflowing. The streets are turning into lakes of excrement. And why? All because of a measly 5 rials. Hatrash went back to work. The story was terrific. The police had been pressured by the mayor's office to confiscate the trucks of the drivers who refused to pay the new fee. But the drivers were being forced to pay out of their own pockets, and many of them scarcely had enough to cover their gas. Sewage from the streets was streaming into people's houses, and although homeowners were willing to pay any amount for service, the drivers were afraid of losing their trucks. The health department warned about the danger of hepatitis, but the mayor's office refused to comment, saying simply that the problem would end soon. For the first time, the Gazette was looking like a real newspaper. The headline of Hassan's next article was, "Municipality Caves In, Sewage Disposal Resumes in Jeddah." Strangely, we were again the only paper to carry the story. Within a week, the drivers were idled once more, over the same dispute. "I just learned something interesting," Hatrash told me one morning. I was gleefully reading his latest piece titled, "Problem Over, Says Mayor, as Jeddah Sinks in Sewage." There was a full page of photographs showing impassable puddles in the streets and flooded front yards. "I have a source who tells me that the decision to impose the new fee came from the governor, Prince Abdulaziz bin Majid," he continued. "The prince sent a letter ordering this new plan to be implemented. They wanted the 5 rial toll to pay for the new sewage dam." The 25 million rial dam, which would back up the existing one, was to be built by the Saudi Bin Laden Group. Hatrash said he had spoken to a geologist who pointed out that the new concrete dam was potentially worse than the old sand one because it would expand the reservoir and add significant pressure to the earthquake fault that ran directly below it. One great tremor would let loose a torrent of sludge that could turn Jeddah into a modern Pompeii. "Let's make a story out of it," I said. "It would be such a relief to tell the truth," Hatrash said. That didn't happen. Once the rumors about the prince's involvement began to circulate, the story died. We soon learned that not only was the prince behind the 5 rial toll, but he was fronting a new company that proposed to build a sewer system for the city, which would cost the kingdom 20 billion rials. None of this information, however, ended up in the Gazette. The editor-in-chief would not print it. Meanwhile, the truck contractors were forced to pay the fee, and the immediate crisis passed. But the prince paid no political price for endangering the health of the citizens and despoiling the city.